Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor here at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as he always does, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Howdy.
Hi there. Yeah. Oh, wait, that's sort of your line.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Or hey there. Today we thought we would continue our we've been doing a few podcasts recently about sort of the predecessors of what we think of as the internet. And we were kind of going to go along those same lines, something that consumers had access to before we had access to the World Wide Web. And that would be online service providers. That's kind of the collective term for these sort of companies.
Online service providers actually were sort of the middle ground, at least the way I think of it, between the older bulletin board services and the internet when it caught on as a commercial entity where people would actually have content that they wanted to sign on. Whereas a bulletin board was sort of a centralized hub where people would log in and log out of for information, an online service provider was like that, only much, much larger. And although you may be going, wait a minute, online service providers, I really don't know anything about what you're talking about. I think you probably have a few coasters sitting around your home that used to belong to at least one of them.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of talk about, you know, you can make a good point about how online service providers kind of bridge the gap between the BBSs and say, the current internet.
Yes.
So if you think of a BBS, most BBSs were run on a single computer.
Yes.
That had a modem line going connected to it, and often you could only have a single devoted phone line going to that BBS. BBS, by the way, stands for Bulletin Board System. So if you wanted to access a bulletin board system, you would have to dial into that bulletin board, and then you would have, assuming that no one else was already connected to it, you could then go in there, read the message board, maybe play a short game. You might even be limited to a specific amount of time before it automatically automatically kicks you off so that you don't just hog all the time of the system.
Right. These were small and usually operated by just one or two dedicated folks who are interested in hosting a service like this. So
right.
You wouldn't want to monopolize the service, because then you wouldn't have anything else from anyone else to enjoy.
You would just be taking up all the time. So these bulletin board systems were fairly primitive. Now, an online service provider was more like a network.
Mm-hmm.
You actually had a couple of steps here. You would, again, you're using a modem, and we're talking about the old dial-up modems. So these are modems that are connected to phone lines. And you would use the modem to connect to, it's a local area connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would dial into a local connection that would then connect you to the overall network. A lot of the online service providers charge by the minute or by the hour, some of them later on would charge by the month.
Right, right. And basically, in this case, if you wanted to sign up for service with an online service provider, you would hope that they had a node local to you. So
right.
They would have a pool, what they would call a pool of modems, sitting there in, say, the downtown area of your of the local large city, and you would dial a local number, and that would connect you to via their own network to, you know, the main servers, and from there you could access the information.
Right, because otherwise you would have to pay twice. You would have to pay once for the phone call, so you're paying the phone operator one price, and then you're paying the operator, the online service provider, and a subscription fee essentially to access their services.
Mm-hmm.
Now these networks, in many ways, especially later on as they began to evolve, started to resemble what we think of as the internet, except for one really, really important distinction, which is that they all remained independent of each other.
Yes.
So if you belonged to one online service provider, so let's say CompuServe, that
yes.
was a famous one, right? And then let's say Chris belongs to CompuServe, but I belong to Prodigy.
Right.
Now, both of those services did have things like electronic mail for their members, but the members could only email other members of that same service.
Right.
So I could not email Chris because we would be on two different online service providers. There would not be a crossover there, because this is predating the era where the internet became available to the general public. At this point, the internet is still really the domain of universities and the government.
Right. I don't want hopefully nobody paused the podcast to write us an email and tell us, no, I had CompuServe and I was allowed to email other people. Yes. Well, there are still CompuServe subscribers. The service still exists, but it's no longer an online service provider. Yes, later on, as they became connected to the internet, you could do this. But what we're talking about is when these services started, because CompuServe, for example, was founded in 1969.
Right.
Which was before, way before the internet actually became a popular service among the, you know, everyday user. You know,
well, in 69, they were still developing the protocols that would form the backbone of the internet, the backbone as far as the software side is concerned.
Right, right.
And,
or at least, that would allow it to be a major network.
Right. There were very few systems connected to ARPANET at the time. There really was no internet.
Yeah, no
at
internet
69.
Proper.
We're talking about, let's say, pre-1990.
Right.
Okay, so before the internet has really become a public utility in a way. If you know, using utility is still kind of misleading, but just to say that it's open to
service.
The public. Service.
A
there
service
you go.
That is open to public.
So before that, you had these private networks that were all self-contained. Now, each private network gave its members access to certain services that, again, mirror what we find on the internet. But what you would find on one service would not necessarily be the same as what you would find on another.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you were a CompuServe customer and you logged in and you wanted to check the news that was available through various articles on CompuServe, it may not be the same selection that you would find if you were a Prodigy customer.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of these online service providers had struck deals with different entities for providing content. Going back to CompuServe, they were the hosts for the first online newspaper in the United States, the Columbus Dispatch from Ohio, signed on in July of 1980, back when CompuServe had about 3,600 total subscribers. And so, you know, they were the ones, if you wanted to read the Columbus Dispatch, that's where you would go. You would go to CompuServe and sign on. And, a lot of other newspapers signed on with CompuServe after that, but, providers like Prodigy and America Online.
Yeah, that's the one we were talking about with the coasters.
Yes, when they would send out lots and lots and lots of discs and people began using them as coasters. People began referring to the discs, which they would get numerous discs in the mail and in cereal boxes and in poly bags that came around your newspapers.
Chucked out of windows of passing cars.
Yes.
I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah, the people used to refer to them derisively as coasters.
Right.
There basically, if you wanted a service, say you wanted a subscription to the New York Times, you might not be able to get it with one OSP. You would have to sign on to another because that's the one that had the content deal in place.
Which means that you would have to pay another subscription fee to another online service provider.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes these early ones were charging by the hour. So you would log on, and it would depend not only on how long you stayed on there, but the speed of your modem connection. And these modem connection speeds, the dial-up ones, were incredibly slow compared to broadband connections. It's almost unimaginably slow for someone who has just started using the internet recently, because most people, even if you're using a dial-up, are traveling at blistering speeds compared to the early ones. And most of the early online service providers were strictly text-based because of this. I mean, it wasn't just that, you know, graphics were challenging to transmit over lines. It's just that the speed of data transmission was so low that it would take forever for you to download a picture. So most of these were text-based, at least early on. Mm-hmm. Only a few would start to develop graphic user interfaces over time.
And those graphic user interfaces in the late, or really in the early 90s, were very primitive compared to what you would see today. I mean, the World Wide Web really has redefined the way that we view interfaces like this. And I think, for someone who is probably new to the internet in the last 10 years or so, if you went back to look at some of the interfaces that these OSPs used back in the day, so to speak, you would go, are you kidding me?
Yeah, no, but for those of us who grew up during this time, or who were using computers during this time, it was really an exciting time, because before then, everything you wanted to do on your computer was restricted just to your computer. Mm-hmm. And you would have to go and you would get software and you would run the software on your computer, but that's it. It was a self-contained system and there was no connection to the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
The modem broke that door open, and first it broke it open with just having computer-to-computer communication, which was already revolutionary for those of us who had personal computers.
Sure.
And that's where the bulletin board system kind of grew out of that culture. But getting to the online service provider, where suddenly you had access to content and you didn't have to go out and buy a disk and put the disk into your computer to look at that content.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, you did have to have the software on your computer so that you could access these online service providers.
Right.
It was essentially a client that you would use, that you would dial into something, and then everything would be delivered through, and you'd be looking at it through the client. But
yeah,
you wouldn't have to, say, go out and get a new encyclopedia type of program in order to see the latest information on stuff. You could log into this online service provider and see it. And at the time, this was revolutionary. You know, before, again, you would just have to wait till someone published something. You would have to go out and buy it, and then you would look at it locally on your computer.
Mm-hmm.
Were you or your family customers of an online service provider?
My wife's family, several of them had actual accounts with OSPs. Personally, since I started using the internet in 1990, actually I was using BitNet in 1990, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
I moved directly to the internet via a shell account. I was using a shell account for a long time, which for the uninitiated is basically a terminal account where you're typing commands in. And I had a shell account, which is Unix-based, I believe, on most services anyway, or at the time it was. until the late 90s, so I really hadn't, and I went from a shell account directly to the World Wide Web without going the OSP route.
Right. Now, as my family, actually, we were customers of Genie.
Ah, yes, the General Electric had a web service called Genie.
Right. And
capital G, capital E.
Yes. And Genie, it offered things like message boards. It mm-hmm. offered email among Genie users. There were games that you could play. Some of them were, like, they even had, like, flight simulators. But they also had the MUDs, or multi-user dungeons.
Oh, yes.
In which several players could all be playing this text-based adventure game all at the same time. Some of the MUDs would even allow you to interact directly with players in more meaningful ways than just being able to talk to each other. You could trade items, or even some of them had the primitive player versus player kind of interactions where you could engage in combat with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why we went with Genie specifically was because of their forums, which
right.
were called roundtables.
Ah, yes.
Now, Genie happened to be a very popular service among a very niche audience. And that would be science fiction authors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my parents are both science fiction authors. So my father in particular at the time, he was the published author. Mom had not written anything with Dad yet at that point. But Dad was a published science fiction author and used Genie to correspond with other science fiction authors. He was a member of SIFWA, which is Science Fiction Writers of America.
Oh, yes.
And through Genie, they could stay in touch with each other in a much more effective way than you know, sending letters or corresponding and you know, traditional methods.
Mm-hmm.
So so I actually got familiar with online service providers fairly early. I also learned very early that most of these meant that I could only be on for a very short amount of time because otherwise I would get in trouble for running up the bill.
Yeah.
Although eventually most of these online service providers, in order to stay competitive, moved to monthly fees as opposed to hourly fees because there were a lot of people were getting more and more accustomed to the idea of having unlimited access for a flat rate as opposed to having to pay on an hourly basis.
Yes, yes.
And back then, of course, unlimited access really didn't mean that much bandwidth still because we're talking mostly text, some primitive graphics, and really your connection speeds were only so fast anyway. So it wasn't like you were jamming up the networks by, you know, accessing the services 24/7.
Right, right. There weren't a lot of people uploading and downloading things like movies, music, or books.
Yeah, seeing
because
as how that
would
have taken years.
A long, long time on a 2400 baud modem.
It would have been faster to go out there and recreate the movie from scratch.
I think you're probably right.
Let's get a cast together. I'm almost certain that's what those kids who did Raiders of the Lost Ark were thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. We could download it, but it'd just be faster if we just performed the darn thing.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and I basically got my start in the internet world, actually working in the internet world as a sales representative for a national internet service provider. And one of the very first things, this was in 1996, and one of the very first things that I had to answer for a lot of people was, you know, why should I sign up with you? And they would come from AOL or Prodigy or CompuServe, and they didn't understand the difference between an internet connection, you know, to the internet itself versus being on one of those services. And to some degree, there wasn't a connection. And in a lot of cases, the content they wanted was probably limited to another OSP that they didn't have access to.
Right.
But it wasn't. It really wasn't long. The mid to late 1990s. I mean, the OSPs put up a good fight for a while because they didn't necessarily – their protocols were not TCP/IP.
No.
They all had proprietary protocols.
Yeah, most of them were packet switching protocols, but it wasn't the same sort of packet switching that you'd find in TCP/IP.
Right. So the thing is, they weren't really compatible with information on the internet. And the thing is, I think it wasn't necessarily the ISPs outselling them. I mean, a lot of the ISPs offered unlimited access around that time, 1996, 97, 98. That was unusual for people like AOL. But at the same time, there was content available from the other services. And I think the OSPs gradually felt pressure to open their networks up to the internet so that you could get things like Usenet news and, you know, some of the web content, because the World Wide Web and an OSP are not the same thing.
Right, right. So some OSPs started to become gateways to the internet.
Yes.
So you could access both their proprietary content or the content that they had partnered with other providers to give to their members, as well as access the wider array of content you could find on the internet, which was almost like open just for public consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And so companies like AOL and Prodigy in particular really, and even CompuServe, really tried to leverage this sort of content to attract people and say, look, you know, yeah, you could go to an ISP, but we're providing that service already, and you get access to this content that you're not going to find on the internet.
Yeah, that was their big compelling argument.
Right. Now, granted, and that worked for a little while.
Yes,
but it was
did.
Definitely a short-term thing. So for OSPs to survive, they really only had one choice, and that was to evolve into becoming an ISP, an internet service provider, because if they didn't do that, eventually the content that had been exclusive to that particular provider was going to make it onto the internet one way or another, because the companies that they were making partnerships with they saw that where the future was, and that the future was that they needed to have an online presence of their own on the internet, and instead of just partnering with an OSP where their content is locked up behind this wall, they wanted to have more control over their own presentation. And so you started to see these companies create websites, and that was sort of the beginning of the end of the OSP business.
Yeah, it was one of those things where people could say, well, you know, I've got access to this company's 19 million subscribers, but look how fast the internet is growing. And, you know, if I make my content available on the internet as well, then I could probably get even more subscribers. And that's gradually the way it's gone. Most of the biggest online service providers still exist in some form, or at least CompuServe and AOL, of course, do exist still. But a lot of the smaller ones that like Genie are no longer with us.
Right.
At least not in their original form.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we've been talking about it, I've been thinking about how OSPs sort of are similar to the net neutrality argument we're having now, where if you are, if you belong to ISP A, you're a subscriber of the internet service provider A, you have access to everything on the internet, but you might have special access to certain types of content that, you know, people from other internet service providers may not have access to, or may have limited access to, or even slower access to.
Right.
And that's sort of, it's sort of in the same vein when you think about it, because,
sure,
you know, there's a perception of exclusivity that belongs to an OSP. If you think back to the time, hey, if you sign up with us, you get all these great things that you can't get anywhere else. Well, you know, if net neutrality goes by the wayside and we, you know, the internet service providers are allowed to regulate the flow of traffic on their own networks, then they will be able to claim exclusivity again.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, that has its own benefits and its own drawbacks. The biggest drawback for me, at least, is that with online service providers, they weren't as regional.
Right.
You could pretty much find a way of being a customer of one of these different or multiple online service providers if you really wanted to.
Yeah.
In any major market. Now, granted, the folks who live in rural parts of the United States and, to expand that across the globe, they often might be more limited, because when we're talking back in the good old days, you were talking about, you know, again, a local phone call. You would have to hope that whatever service provider you wanted had had modems that were within that local area code, and not all of them did. But in most major markets, you would find representations of any of these OSPs there. You would be able to be a customer of any of those. Whereas today with ISPs, at least the major ISPs, you may not have that choice. So it may be that let's just do this as an example. Let's say that Time Warner has access to this amazing array of content, but not everything. Like, you know, it's got, but they have their own.
Right.
And then Comcast has a different selection of equally amazing stuff, but it's different stuff. You might not live in an area that has access to both Comcast and Time Warner. You may have access to only one or the other, which means that you don't really have choice.
Right.
You're forced upon a selection of internet sites or internet services, and you have to be happy with that. You're not going to have the choice of company B, which is why net neutrality is a big deal, because while it's impossible to say that being an ISP, you know, that you're not really a monopoly, regionally you can be a monopoly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Nationally,
true.
They're not monopolies. And there are markets where there are multiple ISPs that you can choose from, major ones,
mm-hmm.
But it's not that way across the entire nation.
Right, right. And it will be interesting to see how the content providers, the independent content providers view these situations, because they're going to have to decide whether they're going to want to sell their content exclusively to a Cox Communications or a Quest,
mm-hmm.
Or an AT&T. You know, if it means that people in other areas don't have access to that material, and they could open themselves up to selling their content to millions more subscribers by making it open across multiple platforms.
Right.
It also might be an opportunity for the satellite internet providers to differentiate themselves, because satellite internet can be accessed by far more people in far more areas, but they have their own set of problems with latency and bandwidth, simply because of the nature of the communication from the Earth to the satellite and back.
Sure. Yeah.
So, you know, online gaming is much more difficult for satellite internet subscribers than it would be for people using cable or DSL or WiMAX, for that matter.
Sure.
So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how that argument plays out. But you can see the similarity there between the net neutrality arguments that we're making today and the OSPs, I think.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Well, that was a good discussion about online service providers. I was actually a little worried about it before we went into it because well, for one thing, I wasn't – when Chris sent me the email, he said OSPs, and I was like, well, Ohio State Police?
That's exactly what I meant, Jonathan.
Yeah.
I don't know how you might have gotten that confused.
Yeah, so I have another – I have half of another podcast that I can record about the Ohio State Police. It's high in the middle and round on both ends.
No, I had seen something on OSPs not too long ago, and I thought, you know, we should revisit that whole thing. And I remember, you know, the really unique proprietary organizations like eWorld for Apple users.
Sure.
And I actually have an eWorld CD at home somewhere, which I'm not using as a coaster because they were far less common than the AOL discs.
Yeah, that's a collector's item.
Yeah.
Mint inbox. Well, I think that was an interesting discussion to have about, you know, again,
yeah,
a precursor to the internet. And now we're going to have just a little bit of listener mail. This listener mail comes from Ryan in the UK, and the subject was, Jonathan's British accent freaks me out. And then the email reads, it's the same whenever I hear you Americans try to speak in our accent. It really creeps me out. Big smiley face. Well, Ryan, I was purposefully doing a terrible British accent for that, thus the whole Dick Van Dyke joke, because Dick Van Dyke's accent in Mary Poppins was about as horrible as you could ask for. My own actual professional acting British accents are slightly better, but I'm not gonna do it because I don't want to creep you out. If anything we do creeps you out, you can let us know by writing us. Our email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. We also welcome all questions, criticisms, podcast ideas, anything like that. Go ahead and send it on in. And Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the new TechStuff blog, now on the HowStuffWorks homepage.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway the great American race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.